Words on Water. Words on Water.
Hi, this is Travis Loop. I'm the host of Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. And I'm here at WEFTEC 2017 in Chicago, and I'm really happy that we have our keynote speaker here today, Freddie Lajavardi. And he has got quite an interesting background. He's a nationally recognized science, technology, engineering, and math educator, and he's worked for, he said, almost 30 years now with students, engaging them, motivating them, challenging them, helping to make science fun, and introducing them to engineering and science careers. Now, Freddie has been featured in, he's got a great motivational success story that we're going to talk about. He was featured in the critically acclaimed documentary Underwater Dreams, also in the major motion picture and best-selling book Spare Parts, and he's in the currently running IMAX film Dream Big, Engineering Our World. So, Freddie, thanks for taking some time to chat with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I think what the listeners would love, they can go check out all that stuff, and we're going to make the links available so they can track it all down. But could you kind of, you know, take a few minutes to tell what your story is? What's this exciting story you have?
So, as a young teacher, I was discovering that, you know, going out and trying to change the world wasn't going to be as easy as I thought. I was kind of limited by the structure of the school and the curriculum and the state standards and everything that you have to reach. So I quickly figured out that I could invite the kids to come after school and we can work on projects together. We started off with simple things like launching pumpkins with catapults and gravity operated, quickly moved into the electric car arena. Right away, I started noticing how students were basically giving up their free time to work on projects like this. And then when we encounter some kind of engineering or physics problem, they start to see the value of why they need to go take the physics class or understand calculus, because we're trying to solve these engineering problems and we don't have the tools to do it.
I can't tell you how many times when I was in high school and stuff that you hear, why do I have to learn fractions? I'm never going to use this in real life. But they started seeing that you can apply these things.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some things in the curriculum which you question, like, you know, one thing is maybe factoring. You know, in life, do you ever factor? But I understand it's a discipline that math wants to teach, so I'm not trying to knock it, but I'm just pointing out an example of where kids see a lack of connectivity to their own life. And so these projects, like we'd go to a robot competition and the kids would ask, you know, why is our robot being pushed around? And say, well, the other team has a better coefficient of friction and probably better gear ratio. So of course comes the million-dollar question, how do we get that?
Yeah.
And so I said, well, you know, if you did physics, you'd understand how to calculate a coefficient of friction and, you know, for lack of a better way, you'd say it's the stickiness between the tires and the carpet. If you're slippery, you're going to slide around. If you're stickier, you won't slide around. But there's ways you can calculate that and decide what kind of material you can use. And then gear ratios, you know. I mean, if I was to walk into a classroom and say, okay, today we're going to talk about gear ratios, there might be one kid that's interested and he's the nerdy kid, right?
Yeah.
Everyone else is going to be ignoring it because they don't see how it applies to them. But if you're on a team that just lost, and they all have that competitive drive and the juice is still in their system, and they know that there's a way to keep from being humiliated by losing, that all they had to do was understand a little math,
Yeah. They're
willing to then put up with, you know, learning how to do the gear ratios. And over time, when they encounter problem after problem, they start to appreciate math as a whole instead of just, you know, one section or one chapter. So eventually they'll say, well, I want to work in this field when I grow up. What kind of courses do I need to take? And pull up the college, you know, list of classes, and it doesn't look as daunting as it did before because they're dealing with some of those same problems now. So they can sort of imagine what it would be like if I go to college and if I stick it through, then this is my payoff. I get to, you know, build electric cars like we did or build robots like we did, but do it for a living instead of, you know, as a club.
Yeah.
So a lot of students have gone on into the fields. Any kind of field, including construction management, civil engineering, mechanical engineering, biomedical engineering. And so I guess I'm living vicariously through them because I don't have any engineering degree at all.
talk, if you could give the backdrop though of the school that you that you've been at.
So the demographics of our school are that it's a Title I school, which is basically meaning that most of the kids qualify for, their families qualify for federally assisted lunch programs. So that's another word, a way of saying they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the parents didn't graduate high school, much less even go to college. Many of the kids, and this is something that never changed over my 30 years there, that every kid that's graduating says they're the first in their family to graduate high school. So I kind of think I figured that out is as the families become upward mobile, they move out of the neighborhood and another family moves in.
Wow.
And so that way I always still have the kid that's the first in their family that's graduating high school, which is a nice thing to hear, I guess, in a way, if it doesn't stop, you know that it's working. The test scores are among the lowest in the state, the high crime rate area. Whatever you think of a typical inner city school with all the problems they have, we're that. It used to be more unique to us, but not so much now that we were one of the largest Hispanic schools in the country, but now that is starting to shift along to other high schools as well. We're about 98% Hispanic.
And you're in Phoenix, the Phoenix area.
Yeah, in downtown Phoenix.
Downtown Phoenix, okay. Yeah. And then so this particular amazing story, what happened with this underwater robotics team that you had?
So we entered this competition because we were looking for something to extend our program into a year-round program. And FIRST Robotics that we were involved in basically covers half the year. So we found this other competition called MATE, Marine Advanced Technology Education Center's National ROV Championships. And since there wasn't a regional in Arizona, we could go directly to the championships. And we could pick one of two categories. At the time, you were allowed to enter in university or high school. So we had learned through our experiences that we learned the most when we failed.
Hmm.
And we wanted to learn a lot so that we could get better at this competition. So the other teacher and I kind of figured that if we're going to learn a lot, we should fail miserably the first year. So we picked the university category. But we sold it to the kids as, hey, you know, if we enter this category and they beat us, no one can say anything because they're all college kids. They're supposed to beat us.
Right.
But if you go in the high school category and you lose, you have to come home and explain how you lost to other high school kids.
Makes sense.
So they took that, but they were made aware that this was a testing year, an exploratory thing. We were going to go and take notes.
Mm.
And then in the evenings, we'd get together and put up all our notes and say, okay, in a year from now, which one of these things that we find out about other teams, whether it was their strategy, their components, or whatever, which one of these things could we accomplish if given a year's time so that we could come back the next year and be competitive? That was our mission. And as the competition unfolded, we started finding out that, you know, we weren't as bad as we thought. We ended up third in the underwater portion. There was also a technical report and an oral presentation. The report you turned in a couple weeks ahead of time, and that was the basis for the oral questioning.
Okay.
And you have to keep in mind that the other teacher and I don't have engineering degrees. So if there was a technical term or word that we needed to use in helping the kids write the paper, we kind of said, well, just use this word. So I think we just made up something that sounded good.
What year was this, by the way?
This was 2004.
Okay.
And so, you know, internet was not very diverse at that time. It was a narrow section of the community used the internet. I think we only had one smartphone, or not even a smartphone, one cell phone amongst all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember who it was. And when we went to the presentation, we were actually afraid to use PowerPoint because of our experience of doing some local events, speaking events, as you know, a team going and talking to grade schools.
Mm-hmm.
PowerPoint might be functioning at your school, but not functional at another school. So our experience was don't depend on the technology. Let's let the kids experience contact with the judges on a human level. And we want the judges to see the kids' emotion, their passion. And we told the kids, you can't compete against these other kids based on, you know, these college kids based on technology because you just don't have exposure to it.
Yeah.
But you can talk about the learning process. What was it? What problems did you encounter and how did you learn how to solve them? And that's what we told the kids to focus on because that's what you did. And it turns out that later when we were talking to judges that we ended up, you know, winning the technical writing award, which we thought was a mistake at first because we thought, how is that possible? But they explained to us that there is such a thing as over-technical writing.
Ah.
That sometimes some of the students would write in excess of what they needed to explain something, and that could turn off the readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know such a thing existed
In a technical document, right? I was going to say, as a communications person that's worked in water and environmental issues, I've definitely encountered that type of writing, and I have to translate it into regular English. But
so,
interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, we even developed, based on some of those experiences, years later when we have teams doing presentations, I have what basically you described. I call them the translators, but they're our public relations people.
Mm.
They're the people that know how to talk to the kids or understand what they're doing engineering-wise, but maybe don't have the skill to do it themselves.
Mm.
But they're able to take that information and then present it to the public in a way that's digestible.
Sure.
Because we also learned right away, anytime we stuck someone up there who knew exactly what they were doing, no one else in the audience knew what they were doing. So there is that need. You know, everyone wonders, you know, how can you be involved in technology? Do you have to be the person with the degree? And the answer is no. There's in any great endeavor, there's a whole team of people, everything from marketing to management to fundraising to the technical aspect to the technical support. There may be people that don't have the advanced degree but understand enough to help the people with the degree.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole plethora of diversity involved in all these accomplishments. And so that's how we try to organize our team. We try to find whoever wants to be on our team, what are they good at and how can they help? I mean, no one pays attention to it, but logistics is important. How are we getting to the competition? How's the robot being transported without damaging it? When are the timelines? When are the due dates? Who's paying for this? How's it being paid for? I mean, you name it. When are we going to eat? Where are we going to eat? Those things that you don't think about that, you know, someone who's good at planning parties would be perfect for that kind of thing. And so you're now the team manager. Manage us.
So the kids are not just learning about this, the engineering part. They're learning about all these other aspects of being on a team and doing an event and being in life. I mean, it's...
We could be compared to basically a small company. Everything that a company does in order to survive and be successful, we have to do in order to survive and be successful. They have a product, we have a product.
Mm-hmm.
They have a whole staff of people to cover all year, we have a whole staff of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially the same thing. The only thing is we don't get paid to do it.
Yeah. Not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea. And so you guys got third in the underwater part and you placed high or first?
Yeah, they take accumulation of the three areas and they add it together to give you the overall winner. So we go to the competition presentation part and we're seeing teams go in 45 minutes to an hour apiece doing their oral presentations and our kids come out in 20 minutes. And so we're kind of shocked. You know, we didn't send them in with all the other stuff. The teams have these big monitors and computers and graphs and charts and scale models. And we just sent our kids in with a three-ring binder that we made so they could stand up on a tabletop with the front side being the graph or something for the judges to see and the backside bullet points so the kids don't forget what to say.
Hmm.
And so that was the only piece of equipment we sent in with them. And when they came out in 20 minutes, the other teacher and I thought for sure that they screwed up. So we started probing, you know, asking questions. And Lorenzo, who's the joker of the group, points to Christian because they didn't get along too well, said that, Christian kind of gave a smart aleck answer. And I said, well, what did you say? And he goes, well, they asked us why we didn't use PowerPoint. He said, I told them that PowerPoint's for people who don't have anything to say. Which, you know, that's a teenager's smart aleck comment, but... You don't know if that offended the judges or if they thought it was cute or what, but it started to look like, okay, maybe the kids didn't speak the way we thought they would have spoken to the judges, maybe disrespectful or whatever.
Mm.
And so we asked a little more and Oscar, the team leader, said, yeah, and they were shocked that we knew and were very comfortable with the metric system. I said, well, why is that? Everything, the rules say everything has to be in metric. He said, yeah, but they really commented that we were extra comfortable with it. And I said, well, what did you say? And he says, well, sir, you know, we all went to school in Mexico and they use the metric system there.
Yeah.
Which, again, I don't know if that's a reason to get thrown out, but the other teacher and I basically concluded that somehow they screwed up and the judges were just being nice to them so they wouldn't know. Because how could you come out, you know, and have a great presentation in 20 minutes when everyone else was taking 45 minutes?
Right.
So we go to the award ceremony and the first thing they do is they announce that they created a judges award.
Hmm.
And they'd never done this before, but they'd never encountered a team like this before. So they then announced it was us. And so right away we thought, okay, this is the pity prize because we entered the university level like we actually thought we could place. And we got obliterated in the other two categories. And then they gave us an award for elegance and design. And that one made sense because we were trying to solve the problem purely from a scientific approach. We knew we were in a pool. We knew we had X amount of time. To us, the batteries always stayed on the robot. That's how we built other robots.
Mm.
But in the ROV industry, that's a totally ineffective, cost-inefficient way to run. Because you can't, every time your robot dies in the ocean, you can't pull it back up and change the batteries. It costs too much. The ocean time is too much. The man-hour times are too much. So they run all their power from the top. So as a result, all the other teams were following that paradigm. So they had these massive cables going in the water for this little robot.
Yeah.
So after so many feet of cable in the water, it almost became non-functional because of the weight of the
copper. Impacted the navigation. And,
And they'd have 15 or 16 wires going in. We had something essentially the size of an Ethernet cable that basically gave us communication signals.
Yeah.
So accidentally, because we didn't know the paradigm, we ended up with this huge advantage.
Yeah.
And it's only because I think we were just looking at the problem as it existed. We weren't trying to fit a paradigm. And there were other innovations in there as well, but that was the key one, the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
So that made sense. Then they gave us an award for technical writing. And I thought, okay, that has to be a mistake. Someone added up the spreadsheet wrong. How could, especially when we know we made up words, how can this be true? And that's when, years later we found out that MIT overwrote their document. They just talked about stuff that wasn't really relevant to solving the problem, just because they like to show off that they knew all this stuff.
Yeah.
So we didn't know any stuff to talk about, so we just listed the problems we ran into and how we solved them. Just basic scientific method.
Not overcomplicating things.
No.
Yeah.
And I guess the words we made up were appropriate enough because they never picked on us for making up some of these words. But, I mean, like one example is it's something that holds all the electronics. I mean, to us, it looked like a lattice, so we called it the electronics lattice.
Wow.
We found out later there's an actual name for that.
Yeah.
We didn't know what those names were. So that's the kind of stuff I mean. It wasn't like we made up a new concept or something. It was just we just didn't know the words for the product, so we came up with stuff. And then they announced the overall winners. And they announced third place as Cape Fear Community College, which was the second place team underwater. So we thought, okay, that makes sense. Then they did an award for second place, and they announced MIT.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, then who the heck is first? And we kind of were doing the math because the top three teams in the automotive portion were way ahead of everybody else.
Mm.
And we concluded that fourth and fifth place team couldn't have passed both of us, all three of us, or both of the other teams. So I concluded that it had to be us.
Oh my
God. Right before they announced it, I remember at the beginning of the project, because I thought it was a very cute thing to see, I printed a list of all the schools we're competing against. There's MIT, Stanford, UC Davis, and Carl Hayden High School.
Yeah.
So I'd highlight our name, and I'd stick it in the hallway, and people would look at it and go, look at who we're competing against, who we're going to get beat by, And Lorenzo walks up and points to one and says, what's MIT?
Oh, geez.
And you can tell right away he had no clue what MIT was.
Yeah.
And after I told him, what MIT was about, with no hesitation, he just said, well, if we beat MIT, will you take us to Hooters? And so I'm thinking, wow, this is a total win situation. I mean, if that's what's going to take to motivate him, I'll let him think he's going to Hooters.
Right.
Knowing I'd never have to ever.
Right, you're not going to have to pay off that
I mean,
bet.
Who would imagine that you win this competition?
Sure.
So now I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's going to start running around the room yelling Hooters. So I reached over the table and grabbed him by the t-shirt and said, under no circumstances, if what I think is about to happen happens, do I want you running around and yelling you're going to Hooters? And he said, but you promised. I said, well, I'm not saying I'm not taking you. It's just don't announce it here. It's not professional.
Right, right.
Because I didn't know what else to say.
Yeah.
So sure enough, they announced it was Carl Hayden High School. And he turned around and mouthed it to me without saying any words. He just moved his lips.
Yeah.
And so that was that.
What a moment. I mean, you probably were just like that feeling you had when that actually happened.
It was a shock because when we came back to the table, I was shaking and I stuck out my hand and I said, everybody stick out your hand. And they were all shaking.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I mean, it never even entered our mind, even in the faintest, remotest possibility that we'd be in that situation. So for that to happen, our bodies were in shock, literally, because now what do you do?
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't prepared for that.
Right.
We didn't have a plan for that.
Yeah.
So we thought we better sit down and let's think this through before we do something stupid because we don't know how to act.
Yeah. What was the reaction of others, you know, the other teams and the judges? And
the place erupted when they announced us, because a high school had never won before. So that was, I still remember screaming. I can't even remember going to the stage or coming back to the stage. That's how emotional I was, detached from the moment, or I shouldn't say detached, in the moment that I was unconscious of everything else. I was just, we won, you know, trying to figure that out as I'm walking up to the stage. And then coming back, we walked right by the MIT table, and they weren't receptive to the win.
Wow.
So that was a little bit shocking.
It's a little disappointing.
And I, you know, in their defense, I have to say that the way we were shocked because we won, they were probably shocked because they lost.
Right.
And so in hindsight, it's easy to kind of see, you know, the gracious thing would have been to shake our hand.
Sure.
But nevertheless, they just got beat by a bunch of kids on food stamps.
Yeah, wow. It's an amazing story. And so I can see why there's been a book and a documentary and an IMAX film. And so we'll, like I said, we'll push that out to folks so they can check that out. So, you know, Words on Water, we have our audience is really the water sector, all these professionals, a lot of people that work in STEM fields and have STEM degrees, and engineers and scientists and facility operators and researchers, all this type of thing. We're really focused on trying to build interest in kids in water careers. You know, we're facing, going to be facing a growing workforce shortage as people retire. So we're trying to show kids the opportunities there are in the water sector, in STEM fields. And it's the water sector is very diverse. What kinds of advice might you have for us water pros, for companies that are out there, for cities that are out there, as we want to try to like reach out to kids and get them excited about that?
Well, I've had a lot of time to think about that, and you're not the first group that's asked us for that kind of advice.
Yeah.
And while I can't say my advice is the definitive answer, I can say that what we've done and what we've seen has worked. And so this is it. If you can create a scenario, whether it's a competition or some kind of apprenticeship environment, where the kids can see firsthand, not just on like a one-day field trip, but something on a repetitive basis, they can go and maybe even give them a little bit of a pay so that they can, you know, they feel like, oh, I'm going here to make some money, but I'm also going to be an apprentice. That idea that we used to have before public schools took over education was the apprentice method. And so you worked with someone. If you didn't like it, you quit and went and worked with someone else. And if you liked it or appreciated it, or, you know, were good at it, you had an aptitude for it, you took over for, you know, the master or the boss after a certain number of years, because now you know enough of that stuff. That's the same thing. I mean, kids have no idea what's involved with all the things associated with water. They just don't have a clue. They basically think water is the thing you get out of your faucet.
Right.
They don't know about the treatment. They don't know about any of that. So my advice would be to try to create programs where you get the kids on site working with people, like a mentorship.
Yeah.
And on an ongoing basis, like a semester or a month or something of that nature, so they can see what's it like to get up every day and do this. If they feel connected and can relate to it, can see themselves doing it, you've now got someone who's going to go into that field and willing to, for lack of a better way of saying it in the education room, put up with all the other coursework they have to do, because they know what's the end goal. And in many cases, I have students that work for companies like Microchip, Intel, and that's exactly what they do. When they are in college, they'll let them have a part-time job as long as they keep their grades up. And they basically work on project with older engineers. And they maybe do the grunt work, or maybe some of the work the engineer doesn't want to do. But they get to see firsthand how the decision processes are made, how the money allocation, you know, system works. So all those things they get. So then they can decide, no, I really don't like the micro semiconductor business, or, God, I can't wait to do this. I'm ready.
And then they're motivated to do the classes and whatever they have to do.
Then the classes are just hoops that they see that they need to jump through to get to the final destination. So that's my advice, is try to figure out programs that can give the kids the experience while they're still in school, so they can make that adjustment in their thinking and in their course selection.
Yeah, that's terrific advice. I like that. I can't wait to have this episode be released so people can hear it, and I can't wait to go talk to others about that. That's some good advice we can run with. wanted to get your perspective also on just the STEM education. You know, you mentioned you've been an educator for, you know, about 30 years. So you've seen a good span of time. STEM is definitely a word that's really kind of became more buzzy and everything. What have you seen in just your perspective on STEM education over the past 30 years?
Well, the problem with buzzwords is that people think that if you actually use the buzzword, that means you're doing it. Mm. And I think that's the problem. Schools are so set up to be in a multiple choice standardized test format of here's the content, we're going to test you on the content, that they forgot one of the tenets of STEM is that there's a thought process that goes along with that. And you can't just talk about the scientific method. You have to have kids wade through it. So the curriculum needs to be set up to where there's problems where the teacher may not even know the answer as well. But instead, the teacher understands how to hold everyone accountable using the scientific method. Because when we're doing projects, half the time we're working on trying to solve a robot technical problem, we don't even know the answer.
Sure.
And so it's important for the students to see what does the teacher do when they don't know the answer.
Mm.
It's the process that's more important in STEM education than labeling a course a STEM class and then expecting the world to change.
And lecturing to them the same way, and here's your multiple choice.
But it's
actually the process of learning that makes it a good STEM.
I think the days of lecturing are over because lecturing, the whole point of lecturing was to provide content.
Mm.
And now you have more content than you can deal with on the tip of your finger through a cell phone.
Yeah.
So the idea that a teacher needs to be the provider of information is antiquated. The teacher needs to show the student, how do you wade through this information? What's real news? What's fake news? What's a real source? What's a fake source? How many sources do I need to validate this before I realize that this is an accurate way to follow through? Who do I contact? What organizations do I look up if I'm trying to find answers? Those are the kind of things that kids need to evaluate. And then once they have something that they attempted, analyze, did it work? If it didn't work, why didn't it work? And what could you change to make it work? So those are the kind of things that is messy in education, and you can't put that on a standardized test. And that's why I think it's very slow in coming to education. Administrators and legislators, I mean, everyone's trying to be held accountable. So this accountability culture has gotten to the point where if you can't show a measurable increase on a standardized test, you're failing in education, which is totally the wrong measurement. There's a great documentary that your listeners should probably watch. It's called Most Likely to Succeed. They follow High Tech High, a school that Bill Gates funds. And in that, they have like a lot of cross-curriculum work between the different subjects, and they can't cover as much material as a traditional high school might. And of course, you know, when they compared the standardized test scores, the traditional high school outscored the kids at High Tech High, and it was supposed to be the other way around. But see, that's only part of the story. Because 6 months later, when they did the same test again, the traditional high school scored lower than the High Tech High. The High Tech High kids scored the same. So what does that say about our education system?
Yeah.
Do we want to teach to the test so they can score high on the test? A test with 6 months later will be irrelevant? Or do you want to teach them the material that's going to stick with them the rest of their life? So what is it that we're trying to measure, and why are we trying to push it? High Tech High emphasized process, collaboration, peer-to-peer evaluation. I mean, all those type of things that you don't have time for in a standard curriculum when you're trying to meet the standardized test goals.
Yeah.
So the standardized test came out of the psychiatric industry, the psychology industry, and it was meant to be one form of assessment. But it's quickly, over the last 10 or 20 years, become the way to measure success in the school. And it is totally not that. It is just one measure. There are so many other measures, like you can test the grit that the student has.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a student doesn't score high on a test, that doesn't mean they don't have grit.
Yeah.
Maybe they had to hold a full-time job. Maybe they were helping take care of siblings while they got B's in all their classes, which were honors classes, and they were also on one of the most competitive teams in the country. But they weren't the A student.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there needs to be a reevaluation on how we judge what the kids are learning and what is it. So for me, I'm interested in the process and creating individuals that know how to think.
Mm-hmm.
I could care less about how much information they can memorize because Google does that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more important that they know how to use the information and determine how to get to where they want to go. To me, that's paramount. And I think schools are somewhat in a revolution, and they don't even know that it's going on. Many, for lack of a better word, neurotypical kids, normal kids, can learn on their own. Anyone who thinks that the days of teaching are going to last forever is deluding themselves. Look at how many online courses you have.
Yeah.
A normal person that has a normal aptitude can go through these courses and do what a person could have done. Now, people say, well, what does that mean to the teaching profession? The thing I tell the students that I see that's coming down, it's not just me, it's anyone who sees this phenomenon happening. You have to make yourself relevant to the economy. And in order to do that, you need to be creative and learn how to solve problems.
Mm.
Those are two things that at least a computer can't do yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to not be replaced as a teacher by a video of a teacher that reaches 10 times more students with quizzes that are online, you need to accentuate what makes you human.
Yeah.
And that, in this case, would be, let's take you for example. Maybe you can do all your other subjects online except math, because you have trouble with math.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a human interaction, because only another human can tell if you're having difficulty learning, how to adjust the curriculum, how to maybe word something a different way, something that a computer can't do.
Sure.
It doesn't have that kind of empathy. Only a human does. So if I was to make a prediction, education in the future, human to human, is going to be reduced to that type of level. And I can say that because all my students are learning how to CAD. They're learning how to use CNC and write G code. I only know these words because I hear them say it. I have no idea what any of these things are, but they're learning it on YouTube and Khan Academy and every place else.
I mean, you're providing the spark, right? That
maybe
human
the spark and
way.
The guidance, and I can ask questions if they found the source. I can, you know,
help them
see if it's valid or not. Yeah.
And help them with that exploratory process. Yeah.
That I have experience with. That's what I bring to the table. But as far as content, no.
And all that helps in life too, right? I mean, those are the kind of skills you need to have to go out on your own and function in the world and all that type of thing.
And one of the things that people forget from time to time, people in public relations and human relations don't forget this is, you know, engineering problems people can solve. One of the hardest problems to solve is interpersonal relationships.
Mm, absolutely.
Learning how to work with people is probably more important than how to figure out an engineering problem because there are so many more dynamics, and it's so much more variable that that's one of the skills they learn in our team is you can hate a person totally, but you know how to work with them.
Yeah.
Because that you're going to encounter that in life. And so many times kids will just be like, I don't want to work with that kid. And go and say, what are you going to do when you get to a job that you don't like somebody? How are you going to deal with that? So the human aspect, even though we're a robotics team, we focus a lot on the human aspect and ethics and morality and, you know, why shouldn't you steal an idea? Or if you're going to use an idea, talk to the team, collaborate with them, ask them if you can use the idea instead of just, you know, our culture of let's just download illegal music because no one's going to know.
Let's talk toward the end here about water. Water is a big issue in Arizona, especially water supply. And, you know, you guys are in the middle of that. And is that something that, you know, your kids hear about and talk about? And, you know, solving water issues is a huge challenge in Arizona, in the U.S., in the world, and increasingly so with climate change and population growth. So when it comes to STEM fields, that's a big opportunity. Can you talk a little bit about water?
My day job is I teach Introduction to Marine Science. So we deal with the ocean.
Okay.
Water in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always bring up the issues that are going on. For instance, a lot of kids will make trips to Vegas and, you know, we'll ask them, did you see the water level at, you know, Lake Mead? And talk about the whitewash that they can see from where the water level used to be. They hear about the droughts in California and the forest fires and all that. So they're aware of it. We emphasize, you know, what's the role of, you know, one person? How can you as a civilian, help mitigate some of that?
And mm-hmm.
So we talk about, you know, water saving, water wastage, like you're brushing your teeth. The common thing, like don't let the faucet run.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, well, it's such a little bit of water. Yeah, if it's just one person. But if it's a million people, now you got a million times more. So all those little things, if you can do your part. The other side is legislation. You know, when you see issues coming up that maybe you have a vote or a say or you can try to sway your congressman, maybe you come up with issues. Like, you know, at some point in the future, I can see golf courses being an issue in Arizona. Is it worth, you know, watering the golf courses? And some people say, well, we use reclaimed water for that. Well, that's okay, but maybe we need to use that reclaimed water to drink.
Right.
At some point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are the kind of things we bring up to the kids. And while we don't, you know, actually do anything at this point in time, it is something that's a point of discussion. we haven't done any projects or anything with that at this point. I mean, our focus has been, I'll be honest, has been the robotics. And in my day job, we do talk about the water. And it is scary because I tell the kids, I go, you guys are living in a time possibly when people are actually going to fight and go possibly even to war over water, because the amount of fresh water is decreasing. Making water clean is not inexpensive. And you have to look at it this way. It's, you're either going to have one of the greatest challenges humanity's ever had, or you're going to have the worst catastrophes that are coming down the line. Mm-hmm. So it's up to you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be dead. Mm-hmm. You guys are going to be the ones to figure out these new technological advances that are going to help make water accessible to millions of people. Something like Dean Kamen's machine. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I know Dean Kamen. He's a Segway inventor, too. And I know he's the first robotics
guy. He has a water purification system that he's come up with that uses any kind of combustible material. So cow patties, wood, any kind of debris that you can use to burn. And then in the process, it runs a Stirling engine that then goes through a whole, it runs a whole little filtration system. He has a documentary out about that whole system called Slingshot.
Okay.
And they've taken these units and placed them in third world countries, like in schools. And the whole community then comes to this water treatment facility. Mm-hmm. What you get. It's what it is. On a small scale.
Yeah.
And they get their free drinking water from there.
Right, right.
The hardest problem hasn't been the technology. It's been delivering these things. Mm. So we had to partner with Coca-Cola, who had the widest distribution system you can imagine, and partner with them. But in order to do that, Coke wanted something in return. So you know those new pop machines that you can mix all the flavors together and it's digital?
Right.
That's Dean Kamen's invention, too.
Oh, wow, really?
So he gave them that. In return, they would help distribute his, I guess they call it Slingshot, the water treatment system to these areas.
Well, Freddie, it's funny, the robotics and the water thing, because directly outside the window here, you see Red Zone Robotics, this booth. And I just happened, I was by there earlier, and they've got little robots that they send into sewers and into water infrastructure so they can look for leaks and check out issues. So they're using, there's some applied robotics right there. I had one last question, just because it's such a big issue. And what are your kids' climate change? You know, I mean, is that something that they're aware of and talk about, and the impacts? And it's crazy to me and a lot of other listeners that the science there is discounted. But what do kids say and think about it?
I think that my perception of how the kids take it is they're listening to their teachers, they're listening to the scientists, and they're frustrated by politicians. They don't understand what's the connection. So why there's a disconnect, I should say, not the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, again, they have all this information at their fingertips, and they find out that we're the only country that doesn't believe in this.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with this? So we have to kind of explain corporate America politics and kind of say that, you know, costs money for these companies to do this, and they're about making profits, and so they put pressure on the politicians, and so at least the best that we can explain.
Yeah.
And they say, but how can they not see what's coming? And I say, well, some people don't think that far ahead in the future, or they don't care about it. They're only concerned about, you know, the quarterly profits. They're worried about what's going to happen because they're going to lose their job if they don't make profits. And there's rationale behind why they're doing it. You might not agree with the rationale, but it's there.
Yeah.
So they say, well, how can we combat it? I said, you've got to vote. You wonder, you know, people say, well, my vote doesn't count. That's the biggest mistake you can make.
Yeah.
Because in the case of, you know, us beating MIT, that was 1 point. So the smallest of difference can make a huge sea change. What if we had lost? Right. Would I be sitting here talking to you right now? Probably not.
Just like that turning off the tap, it all adds up.
Yep.
Right? Your part.
So you're trying to communicate to the kids, okay, you know, your elders now have let you down. Are you going to continue down this road of self-destruction? Or are you going to rise up and say, okay, now it's our turn. You guys didn't know how to run the world. Mm-hmm. We're going to come and show you this is what it is. And that's the feeling I get from the kids. It's just they feel frustrated because some of them are pre-voting age and they can't do anything about it for the time being. But I think teachers, or at least what I've seen in education, I've never met a teacher that's pushed the other way. It's always for, you know, staying in the climate accords. And, you know, it's just, it boggles the imagination.
Yeah. Follow the science here.
Yeah.
Well, and just in wrapping up here, you know, I've got a first grader and a fourth grader, and I'm fired up. I've always cared greatly about their education and looked to get them into opportunities. And now with your talk about what's important in education, when I go back home from this conference, I got to take even a harder look into what we're doing in school and keep them in all these like inquiry-based mm-hmm. opportunities and stuff. So you've fired me up personally. I know you fired up a couple thousand people this morning at our opening general session, and I'm glad that we'll get to get this podcast out. And just thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And just the advice for you and your kids, even if you can't find a school that can do it, if they incorporate an after-school program that promotes it, the damage can be reversed.
Well, my fourth grader is into marine biology, and so where we are, there's a university, and so he's going to like these Saturday morning programs to kind of learn for a couple hours and all that stuff. So there's like you said, there's outside opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So. And I would encourage you to keep him involved in that as much as possible, because if a school refuses to make the change, because they may be under political pressure. And usually when I see a school that's bragging about test scores, you also see that they don't have the critical thinking skills. They're so focused on the test scores. I've had private schools in the area, I won't name names, that have come and visited our school and then point blank tell us that they don't have time for these kind of programs because their kids are all taking AP classes. And I said, well, that's great. You know, I might not have as many AP students as you, but I do have a few. And if my kids go to a job interview against your kids, my kids have underwater robotic experience, land robot experience, they've been in science fairs, and they got a 5 on the AP calculus, and they went to a college that's comparable to the college your kids went to. Who are they going to give the job to?
Yeah.
And the next year they had a robotics team.
Wow.
So they understand the point I was trying to make, that, you know, academics is one thing, but it can only get you so far. And anyone who lives by academics is also going to die. Academics, because there's a lot of CEOs that tell me that when they get employees, the first thing they have to do is train them because they didn't learn anything in college.
Oh, wow. They've just memorized some facts, passed some tests about how they solve problems. And again, from the water sector perspective, we got a lot of challenges to address, so we need problem solvers. But Freddie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Words on Water.